So as he, Dan had said, I'm Kevin Jablonski, primarily patent attorney, although I like to dabble a little bit in the copyright and trademark side of things, which is all part and parcel of what we call intellectual property law. As he kind of said, I'm welcoming any questions you might have as we go along, but I really need to tell you that I'm not giving you legal advice. We are having a discussion about the law. So I don't want any of you to think that I am your attorney and then go out and act on this and then disappoint yourself and then sue me. But we can certainly have an open discussion about it. Also, I'll throw out the caveat that I do primarily practice patent law, so I know a lot about patent law and specific electronics on the side of patent law. And if my dabbling in the copyright side of things is something I do, I have a pretty good idea about what's going on and this, that, and those, and some of the proposed legislation, but I'm guessing that there's a few people in the room that have maybe investigated in a much greater detail some of these things that we might be talking about, specifically like the PIPA and SOPA proposed legislations that we'll talk about here a little bit tonight. So I'm welcoming any additional input and expertise that a few people might have or bring to the table on that. So with that, let's jump over into a little bit of an overview of what I was going to talk about here with us all tonight. So we're going to review intellectual property in general because not everybody kind of has a handle on it like an attorney might. Some legislation that had recently passed is something called the America Invents Act. I'm going to talk a little bit about this and its impact on patent law, but I got to warn you, it's really boring and it's not interesting at all. So We'll talk a little bit about that, and beyond that, I'd like to get into more interesting things. Google book settlement thing, we'll talk a little bit about what happened there. Long and short of it is Google wanted to digitize every book that exists and make it searchable, and there are some questions about whether or not they should be able to do that from a copyright perspective. Termination reclaim is another thing that's kind of interesting right on the horizon that we'll talk about. Other interesting cases, and then kind of the SOPA PIPA that we had just talked about, the Stop Online Piracy Act and the Protecting IP Act, which are House and Senate competing versions of a law aimed to help copyright holders sort of police all of their copyrights from a worldwide perspective, different foreign entities that might be infringing on some of their works. And finally, if we have some time, we'll talk about DJ Girl Talk. Not really in the news, but always an interesting, fascinating thing that's just waiting to be in the news as soon as somebody decides to sue this guy. So, let me talk a little bit about intellectual property in general. When we talk about intellectual property, what we really mean to say is this is something that is property that somebody can own, but it's not tangible. Very easy to wrap your head around the idea of physical property. I have a car, I have a house, I have an iPad, that if you take my iPad from me, I no longer have an iPad, and you have my iPad. So this one single physical thing can only be possessed by a single person at any given moment in time. Well, when we talk about intellectual property, we're talking about an idea, the expression of an idea, a relationship between a seller and a consumer that can be possessed by many people simultaneously. And if I tell you about my idea, all of a sudden we both have possession of that idea. That's a little bit harder to get our heads around. So when we talk about intellectual property, we're talking about a non-physical type of thing that exists in the ether. Well, how do you go about protecting that? And it's primarily through different contracts that we enter into, different rights and reservations of those rights that we agree as a society to grant to the producers of this intellectual property. And then the exchange there is after that time has run for those rights, we give the underlying subject matter to the public. So patents and copyrights can kind of enter the public domain where everybody can use them once they're there. Or so we think. We'll talk about reclamation here in a second. So patents, I kind of skipped over that one real quick. Patent would be an original, which is to say novel, non-obvious, useful idea. This is more tied to something physical, a process, a method of manufacturing, devices, to where if you come up with an invention of sorts that has never been done before and is also not obvious, like an obvious tweak, and that's a really legal term, obviousness. If it's not obvious in light of what else has been done out there, you're entitled to a patent for 20 years from the date you file for this patent. I'm not going to get too much into that, but it's important to know that patents are a really large part of the intellectual property world and control a lot of the devices and licensing between companies that control this, that, and those, and any number of things that are out there being produced. Copyright law. In the music side of the world, we're all pretty familiar with what this is, at least in some sense, where a copyright is the ability for an author to protect their expression of an idea. So there's probably 100 different ways to tell the particular story of Cinderella, but if you tell the story of Cinderella from a particular point of view, like from the stepsister's point of view or something like that, and you create this new and interesting way to tell this story, you're able to get a copyright in the version of Cinderella that you've told. Notwithstanding the fact that Cinderella is under copyright by Disney, it might be considered a derivative work, but at least to some extent, you've got a copyright in your version of it if you can get Disney to agree to allow you to produce that derivative work for money or whatever. Or they might buy it from you or something to that effect. But one could easily see how sometimes copyrights start nesting with each other, that you create something, I take that, I start creating something else with it that is also now new and interesting, but since I am using your underlying work, I'll need to get permission from you, and then I create something with it, and then somebody wants to take that and maybe create something further with it, would need both of our permissions to do that, and that can get quite complicated after a while. So if you create something right brand new from the beginning, you own the copyright in it. And kind of interesting to understand that you don't need to register for a copyright. Sometimes that's a bit of a misnomer. You don't need to register for a copyright in order to have rights in your original work. It exists from the very moment in time that you put pen to paper, so to say. So the two caveats for establishing the copyright would be any kind of original expression of an idea, and then that it's fixed in a tangible medium. And these are statutory terms that are in the 17 U.S.C. Copyright Code of the United States. We can interpret that in a bunch of different ways, like what does it really mean to be an original work of art or original work of any kind? A case from years ago established that a list of phone numbers in the white pages of people's names plus their phone numbers that were in alphabetical order in and of itself is just simply a list of facts. But if a company that's producing that white pages list decides to include fake people every now and again that they made up, Alan Aardvark, Johann Strauss, who doesn't live anymore, they put that in there in a few different places, well, they've created something. They chose to express their idea of what it is to have a set of white pages and a list of phone numbers with these particular names here and there. And that's an original expression. And it's fixed in a tangible medium, which is the paper it was printed on. Well, there, you've got a copyright in your white pages. If I painstakingly go through and find all of the fake names you've done and remove them, and then use the rest of your assembly, then I'm beyond it, because now we're just presenting a list of facts again. But geez, if I'm going to go through the trouble of finding your fake names, I could probably just produce them in the first place. So the takeaway from that is the level of any kind of originality here is very, very tiny. Yes?
It's common on the internet for people who like a particular storyline to do what's called fan fiction. Mm-hmm. And they basically appropriate the characters and maybe a portion of a storyline or the ending of a story, and then they go on from that. That seems like it's in violation.
Kind of sort of is. It's what we might call a derivative work, where an author has created a certain set of characters, already established a storyline of sorts, a history of characters, and the fan fiction is theoretically a violation of the author's copyrights, but what author wants to discourage fan fiction is kind of the question at that point. That, geez, if you're to the point where you've got fan fiction going on, isn't that a good thing? So you could, let's suppose I wanted to write a Harry Potter 8 book and then continue right on from when they were older and their kids are now going to school. And now I start to make a lot of money because I created that. J.K. Rowling is going to come knocking on my door saying, well, no, I own that. But to the extent that I put something out there on the internet for free and I'm really not making a lot of money, yes, you could try to go and stop it. You have the right within your copyrights to say, I didn't authorize this derivative work, but are you going to enforce it?
Right.
So it always comes down to the owner of that copyright has the choice as to whether or not why they want to enforce their copyrights. And a lot of the times it's going to matter on, are you making a lot of money off of something that I should be making money off of, and so on and so forth.
Can you lose a copyright by not enforcing your copyright on it? Does it go into the public domain?
It does not.
Okay.
It only goes into the public domain after the copyright expires, which, under current law, is 75 years after the author dies. Or 90 years after a corporation publishes it, or 120 years after a work for a corporation was originally created. That was convoluted. What I mean to say, let me explain it a little better. So you can distinguish works created into two sort of camps. You've got, I'm an author, I'm a musician, I created this for me, that this is my expression of an idea. Or I work for Disney, and Disney has hired me to create part of Cinderella. So when a work is for work made for hire, the ownership is always going to be at this corporate level, and the corporation or the person commissioning the piece of art, so to say, whoever is directing the art, paying for it essentially, then has a copyright in that for 90 years from the date in which it's published. Or if they have something created back in the back room and they sit on it for a bunch of years and then publish it maybe 50 years after it was created, they only get 120 years from the actual date of creation. So you can't be a corporation and say, you know, we're going to have Mickey Mouse for years upon years upon years and have all the stuff created from the original creators and then sit on it in a vault and then eventually release it 120 years later, so to say, from these really great artists or something to that end.
Copyright for software still has the same issues on ownership. The multi-part test, doesn't it? For example, who provides the machine, who provides the software, who provides the direction, where you're doing the programming, that sort of thing. So,
right.
In other words, if I hire a programmer and I give you a machine and now you do the flow charting and I say this is what I want you to do, then rightfully I could, and it's all within my environment, he has to show up 9 to 5 at my presence in my office, and I would, in theory, own the copyright. But if the guy brings his own machine and his own software, he just kind of takes a little bit of direction from me, sets his own time schedule, does a lot of it at home, then even though he's doing it for me, which one might scream to work for hire, it effectively still belongs to him.
It depends if you're under contract.
No.
There's
because the contracts are part, yeah, that's I think a misnomer, having done software for years, because the contract says I own it doesn't mean, I think in software, it doesn't necessarily mean that you own it. Because it's controlling the environment and how it's created, I think,
Yes. Boy, that was a really loaded question.
I just wonder if the test is still there, it's been modified, because it's...
It's the same concept. So what you're trying to establish is, well, what defines a work for hire?
Right.
If somebody is creating something, are they an agent of me? Or are they doing their own thing, so to say, and I'm just providing a place for them to work? So an example the other direction is, I own a studio and a band comes in and does work in my studio. I own the studio, I provided them the equipment, I maybe even engineered it, but I'm not anywhere near owning what they've created.
Right,
because they weren't under my direction. There's all kinds of factors that go into that. The best way to avoid that is to have a contract that says you are working as a work for hire for me. Anything you create is a work for hire. If the contract says that, test is out.
I think it still goes if you don't have control of the environment, though. Because brings his own equipment. I think in the software side, he brings his own equipment. He brings his own software. I provide him nothing except the whole and a sign saying you it's a work for hire.
I'd argue the other way. I'd argue the other way, and I think I'd win.
Owning 30 years for the copyrights on software, I think I would win.
Okay, well, let's leave it at that.
It's crazy. You know, it cuts a lot of different ways, and sometimes.
Yeah, the other thing is, like, the thing on copyrights, music and otherwise, I know for copyrights, to copyright something, it used to be we took like 7 lines of code at the beginning, 7 lines of code at the end, or whatever it was, wrap it up and send it to the copyright office, and that's a copyright. How in the heck do they know what's a copyright if the line number 8 is shifts between what you write and what I write, if the first 7 lines are the same?
They don't care. They'll just give you the copyright. Then to enforce it, you've got to prove that somebody else copied
the first 7 lines.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier that if you were going to do a derivative work, you have to ask somebody the original's permission.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a different penalty if you ask permission and they get turned and you get turned down, but you do it anyway, versus you don't ask permission and you just do it? Is there a different penalty between those two?
It probably speaks to willfulness. So under copyright statutory code, so let's say we've got a registered copyright, it kicks in statutory penalties for these. So all I need to do is prove that some copying took place. As long as I prove that copying occurred, then the person doing the copying is on the hook for $30,000 per work, up to. If I can prove that it was willful, $150,000 per copy, up to anyway. So it's pretty good evidence to say, you came and asked me permission. I said, I don't want you to do that. And you did it anyway. That speaks right to willfulness. So, yes, that's a significantly 5 times increased penalty, possibly. That and the interesting thing about statutory damages versus, I guess I'll just jump into this whole topic. I said earlier that you don't need to register your copyright in order to enforce the rights. But if you do, you're entitled to statutory damages. So now I don't have to prove what my damages are. I simply have to prove there was infringement. And then I can get up to $30,000 for that work. If I don't have it registered, then I've got to prove to a court of law how much I've been damaged. So they downloaded 6 songs in Germany, and there was 4 songs in China, and then another 8 songs in Wyoming, and that's $14. So I'm going to sue you for $14. I'd rather just prove there was copying and get $30,000.
Does the mail it to yourself scenario for your whatever work you're doing, your packages, seal it, mail it back to yourself, so it's got a date on it, still hold as being a valid copyright? Or is that long gone?
It never did hold.
Okay. So let's
talk about this. This is kind of a big myth that's out there that, in the past, instead of paying the $30 to the government, $40 to the government to register the copyright, some people paid 35 cents to the government to mail a package to themselves and then not open it, saying, well, at least this proves, because of the date stamp up top, that I had possession of whatever is in the envelope at least as early as that date stamp. Which, in the end, all we're really looking to do is prove that you had possession of it. So if I can show you the files on my computer, or this notebook that has a date in the corner for the lyrics to the song, or anything else, it's all evidence. So that could come in as evidence. It doesn't really establish anything further than the rest of that stuff does. And it certainly doesn't go to the level of a registration. So what would typically happen, you've got this thing. It's so very easy to, if I'm on the other side of that, I'll say, wow, you know, I can probably put a date stamp on an envelope too and call it U.S. Post Office and fake that pretty easily. That's how I would poke a hole in that to say that's not really good evidence of you creating it. What you really need is the whole picture painted that I work in a studio and I'm a musician myself and here's some notebooks and here's all my computer files from the iteration 1 to iteration 100. And then you're painting a much bigger picture that's harder to poke holes in to say I own it. Honestly, that never comes up. Very few times do you ever get into a situation where person A says, I created this exact thing, and then person B comes along and says, no, I did. And here's all of my stuff that says I created it, and here's all of my stuff that created it. What are the real chances of people coming up with so identically close of an expression of an idea that it's usually pretty easy to tell who's lying and who's not?
In music, this wasn't the fifth dimension suit, the up, up, and away scenario. Was that 5 bars or 8 bars that was considered, if you copy that much, it was considered stolen?
Not familiar with that case. Anybody heard of that one? A seminal case in there is George Harrison versus the Chiffons. And it actually established what we call the substantial similarity test. Mm-hmm. So Chiffons recorded a song in 1968 called He's So Fine. 1975, I think it was, 76, George Harrison comes along with his song called My Sweet Lord. And the Chiffons said, that's too close. It's got the exact same melody line, same chord structure, same verse-chorus structure, and it's just too close. So the court agreed with the Chiffons and said that it was too close, that there's no way that George Harrison creates that song without somewhere along the line hearing He's So Fine. And in the end, that was a decision by 12 people in a jury that said, I think he copied. Did he actually copy? I don't know. Is it possible that somebody on the other side of the world creates a song so close to another song, but actually derived it completely and totally independently? It is possible. And you just need to prove it to a group of 12 people that, yeah, I've never heard of the He's So Fine song. It's not like it was on the radio or something. Well, yes, it was.
And he lost the case, and he paid, right?
He lost, he paid.
And years later, just last year, that Billy Preston was the guy who was actually the keyboard player for the session in the studio who came up with that hook one day in a studio session that wasn't actually George Harrison.
Interesting.
No, I thought it was interesting.
Another interesting thing was about 4 years after that case came down, George Harrison bought the song from the Chiffons. So there's that.
Was he then able to recoup whatever fines went along with his?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, money changed hands. Sometimes it's not public knowledge. But it's just kind of funny that he ended up buying the song just the same.
Yeah.
So the long and short of it is the substantially similar test has all of these different bullet points of sorts that a jury would consider and say, how close is it? Is the melody line the same? Is it even in the same genre of music? This one's country, this one's hip-hop. Don't know. You can make arguments this way, that way, in many ways, but by and large, you never really get into a situation where here's a version of like a Metallica song, and here's Metallica also singing it. Don't know how those guys got into their studio and sound exactly like them. I don't know. So, you know, that's just kind of the far-fetched, in theory, legal types of topics that we sometimes grasp but try to get a head around, but never really comes up.
At some point, would you address the issue of, like, an Irish folk song, Whiskey in the Jar, that Thin Lizzy and Metallica recorded, and what distinguishes where the copyright comes in?
So, yes, that's a really interesting question. So now we've got some of these traditional songs. By the way, I'm in an Irish band too, so and I do Whiskey in the Jar. And so Whiskey in the Jar, old traditional Irish tune that's in the public domain. Then Thin Lizzy comes along in the late 70s and does a version of it. So their version of it is under copyright. So they've got their particular expression. So he sang it with certain inflections. They slowed it down to this tempo. Those particular stylistic choices are considered to have some form of a copyright attached to them, but not so much so that I couldn't repeat some of those stylistic choices with my entire new band and entire new singer. Mainly the copyright is in the underlying music recording itself. And we can kind of start to distinguish between a copyright for the writing of the song, sometimes called author's rights, versus the musician's rights in the actual playing expression of the song. And that's an even more difficult concept to sometimes wrap around.
Yeah.
Also, Peter Palmieri recorded it in the 60s as well. This would be a case more where it's the arrangement that's copyrighted, not the tune.
There's that. And, you know, all of us in this room could possibly make an argument for the engineer's particular choices on the reverb used or some of the EQ settings. Are you now starting to shape the sound to the point that the engineer is creating some facet of the song? Yes, but let's also understand we're still work for hire, so it's all theirs anyway. So, because they're bringing us the stuff, and we're under their direction, even though we might be the ones saying, you don't want to do that. You don't understand. But nevertheless, any form of originality that you bring to the table is subject to its own copyright.
I think Bob Dylan recorded under the name Blind Willie Grunt when he was contracted to Columbia. Is that a copyright kind of thing or a work for hire where you sign up a company and they keep everything you do?
Typically, when you're the musician, you're going to sign a record deal. And the record deal often says, I agree to produce music for you, record company, and give you all of the rights to the underlying songs and the copyrights. So the record company is paying for the copyrights. They're going to help you sell the music by supporting a tour, selling albums, giving you some money on the album sales. But by and large, they own the masters. And then they can go do stuff with the masters. Sometimes artists get into long-term deals where they say, you, Bob Dylan, are going to produce 10 albums for us. Or, better example, you, Prince, are going to produce albums up until 1999 for us. So Prince changed his name.
Is that what he did to get out of a contract?
He did it to get out of a contract.
Is that
probably not. But they didn't. I guess to enforce your rights, then you got to sue Prince. And there are probably better ways to pass your time.
Record companies sue their customers all the time.
They do, but they didn't. And probably because Prince was making a good amount of money for them already on all the other albums and the whole backlog. Yeah, but theoretically he was saying, well, I'm not recording under the name Prince. You've got a contract with Prince, and that was a fake name in the first place. So now this is my new persona, which is a new fake name, which isn't even a name. It's the sound of breaking glass. I don't know if anybody knew that. His little symbol, the sound, the phonetic sound that symbol is the sound of breaking glass. So when you see that, you say, I love that song by and then people are going to look at you funny, but you'll know. So a lot of copyright questions are going to come up, a lot of copyright cases to kind of talk about here that happened in the last couple of years that I'll get to some more.
Oh, just to clarify, all that discussion was about authorship of the work. And there's the authorship, and there's also the recording.
Right.
Copyright.
Yeah. So there's going to typically be a copyright for the writer, whoever wrote the song and the lyrics. Sometimes that's even two different people. And then a copyright for the performer. A lot of the times it's all into one. You got singer-songwriter type of thing. But a lot of the times you're a famous singer, and you're famous already for being Lady Gaga. But you can't write music for nothing, so you have people write it for you. I'm not sure. Does Lady Gaga write her own stuff? I'm assuming.
Yes and no. And there's a question in one of her songs that wasn't Madonna's.
Right. Yes and no. I mean, Madonna didn't write a lot of it. She wrote some of her stuff, but not all of it. But it really doesn't matter. When you're Madonna, you can sell whatever somebody writes for you. And there's quite a lucrative business for writing songs for Madonna. So, but, you know, that's all handled in the backside contracts to say, all right, you're the writer, you'll get a writing credit for it, but now I'm the record label giving you the deal, so I own it, and I'm going to put Madonna's performance with it together and keep the copyrights together now so I can do things with it too. Trademark law is the third big facet of intellectual property law. There's two more that I'll talk about briefly, but trademark law, we've all seen different trademarks for Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Nike, Microsoft, anything you can think of that are company names or the long and short of it is a trademark is some sort of way for a producer of a good or service to protect this establishing of a relationship with their customers. So when I buy a Pepsi, I'm really expecting to get Pepsi. I don't want coffee or anything else that doesn't taste like Pepsi. And so this allows these companies to not allow other companies to then market goods and services in that particular channel of goods and services under these protected names. So if I'm Pepsi, I can stop any other beverage company from using Pepsi to sell beverages. But I really can't stop a car company if they wanted to call their car Pepsi. There might be ways that I could argue that it's delusion. I could get creative, and I could say you're just trying to create confusion. But
Apple Computer and Apple Records was the famous case of...
Glad you brought that up.
Apple had to give Apple Records, Apple Computer had to give Apple Records a whole lot of money when they got into the music business.
So Apple and Apple have been arguing for years and years and years over this. When Apple Records has been around for a long time, they own the Beatles catalog and several others. For the most part, Apple Music was the marketing arm of the Beatles. And so they've been around since the Beatles have been around. Long about, I don't know, 80s, whenever Apple Computer came around, they wanted their own trademark in Apple, and they applied for it. Apple Music, with their trademark in Apple, argued and said, that's, you know, we already have Apple. And when we're talking about these trademarks in the lines of goods and services, the particular good that we're talking about here is class 9. There's 46 classes of goods and services. The first 38 or 39 are goods, and then services up to 46. So class 9 is scientific apparatus, which, what does that mean? Well, strangely enough, it means both computers and music. Music is a scientific apparatus, believe it or not. At least the printing onto a phono record or a cassette tape or a CD or whatever. So when companies that are producing music go out to get their trademarks, they usually get a trademark in class 9 for the pressing of the music in some fashion, and then also in the service of producing or playing the music or performing the music or doing services with it. So right away now we've got Apple Computers and Apple Music all within class 9. So the trademark office is saying, we may have a problem here because you both want Apple in the same class of goods. Apple Computers was able to convince the trademark office that, look, we do computers, they do music. Why on earth would a computer company ever want to sell music? They won that argument then. And it kind of stands to reason that a lot of times you're trying to convince the trademark office that there is no chance of consumer confusion. That why would a consumer ever think that a computer company is producing Beatles music?
Oops.
Yeah. So then Apple did what Apple did for the next 20, 30 years, grew into the largest company in the entire world at roughly $500 billion of market cap. I think they just went above $500 billion. And a great, great chunk of what they make money off of is music. Hands down. So if you thought it was funny for years and years that you went to iTunes and you could never download a Beatles song, it's because of this argument. So they were suing each other and back and forth trying to negotiate, what are we going to do here? They finally came to an agreement to play nice together. This is just what it came down to, that it's probably a good chance that Apple Music could have stopped Apple Music could have stopped the Apple Computer Company from selling music using the Apple name. They would have had to come up with something else. But Apple's got some good lawyers, too. So sometimes that's just argue until it hurts. And by hurts, we mean both sides are spending a gross amount of money. And in the end, they just came to an agreement to say, let's just agree to play in each other's backyard and... That's that.
Is it about the time that Michael Jackson bought Apple? Or did he if I just looked there.
He just bought the Beatles catalog.
I think he just bought the catalog.
He didn't buy the company. I thought he ultimately ended up.
That was before the Apple thing. I think he bought the publishing rights of the stuff that was pre-Apple.
Right. I'm not. Yeah, I don't know for sure what Michael Jackson bought, but I don't think one had something to do with the other.
Did the company formerly known as Apple Computer have to pay Apple Music money to get it to the music business?
I don't know. There was all confidential settlement.
I suspect there was some money changing hands.
It probably was. That in the end, it would have been really bad for Apple Computers to have to market under something else or change their name. So, yeah, at that point, you just... pay some money and everybody's happy, sort of. Trademarks.
So the trademark extends to the fonts. I mean, it's not just the name.
Interesting. You should bring this up. I had this happen today, and I got to figure out how to get around it. So a trademark can be the word itself, Apple, in any way, shape, or form. If I do it in cursive, if I do it in a different language, possible I can still extend my protection to the different language, depending on what the other company's trying to do with that. If they're clearly trying to trade on my name in a different language, then I got issues with that. But the long and short of it is you get a trademark, you distinguish whether you're going for the words themselves or the stylistic expression of it. And smart companies get both. Today I'm dealing with a less than smart company that only got the stylistic representation of the word, and now I got to figure out how to enforce the word. It's Reamp, by the way, and we talked about it at dinner, that a client of mine has the trademark for Reamp, but the stylistic version of it. So I got to see if I can enforce the underlying rights to the word itself in the area of consumer electronics, or not even consumer, but just Class 9 scientific apparatus. And I think the answer to that is going to be no. So, like I said, smart companies get both.
So you registered twice, actually?
If you want protection in the style. So the word Reamp, we'll keep using that as an example.
The Apple logo, right?
So there's the Apple logo. Well, let's pick Microsoft even. So Microsoft, the word, is protected. Microsoft, in their leaning block letters, is also protected. So I can't do MicroRoft with leaning block letters, which would be an obvious attempt to try and kind of maybe trade a little bit on that. People don't look at it close. They see the leaning block letters. Yeah.
Will UPS trademark the brown van?
The brown color, brown, yeah. Right. They've got some trade dress rights in the area of delivery. So, yeah, because people have come to recognize that what can brown do for you? Coca-Cola has a trademark in the shape of their bottle, a trade dress one. McDonald's has golden arches. NBC has GBC. Bom, bom, bom. You can't sell other television shows on other networks using GBC in rapid succession. Like that.
I have a bunch of slides that I picked up of European castles from 57 to 83 or so. And I was talking to an online slide place, and they said that a lot of these castles have made trademarks of their shapes. Mm-hmm. So you can't actually even publish the pictures of the castles that control them. Have you heard that?
I haven't heard that.
Who owns the rights to that castle that was the basis of Disney's castle? That's a real castle.
Neuschwanstein.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
Is that Disney on it or that?
That's the thing.
To me, that would be really... Because castles look a lot alike because they're castles.
And from which sides, too, is another question.
Right. So they can try that, but in the end, as a consumer, you got to prove to me that when I see that castle, I think of what you just said.
Yeah.
Right. Versus when I see that castle, I think of Disney. That's more feasible than the other one.
It's probably in the European market as compared to the...
It could be. I mean, if you ask an average European if you'd recognize that castle, it's probably different than an average Canadian
or American. But the other slides that I have, though,
Yeah. That'd be a tough one to argue. An interesting attempt. I guess anytime you try to enforce your IP rights, as long as the other side backs down, you've won. That's not a good thing to stand on. But I think in that particular case, with what you've presented me, is I don't think that they would get very far with that idea.
It's like iStock Photo. I talked to them, and they said, well, because you have to have full rights in the slides that you put onto the iStock Photo.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't take castles because they are
interesting. And for iStock Photo, that's usually a good safe harbor to just play in, that don't even want to have that argument, so we
no
just won't.
No gray at all. Basically.
Right. Yeah. Although they could probably win that one, but why bother arguing when it doesn't really affect your underlying business?
Right.
Trade secret law is another facet of intellectual property. I'm not going to talk too much about this, but formula to Coke, Colonel Secret Chicken, customer lists. Yeah.
Is it the same as a process patent?
No. This, a trade secret is something that you might use to protect something that you'd rather not disclose to the public. Like, the idea behind a patent is that I'll tell the whole world about what my patent is by publishing a patent application. And in exchange for getting 20-year monopoly on doing that, I dedicate after 20 years to the public. Whereas in a trade secret, I don't want anything to go public. I want this in perpetuity. I've come up with a great new formula for good tasting soft drink, and I don't want anybody else to have that, ever. So I'm going to try to keep that secret.
What would happen if, say, you have the secret code formula, say, and I figured out what it was with a chemistry set or a real lab, and on April 1st next year, when it's first to file, I file the patent on your trade secret? Who gets the control over that IP? You have it as a trade secret first, but I filed the patent and we're going to first to file.
Let's assume that you can't ever derive what it is if with your chemistry set, because I don't think that can be done, because it would have been.
I don't know about
that. Technology is getting better.
But is technology is getting better. That's kind of an interesting question, that if somebody else comes up with it, well, then it's not really a secret anymore, and you didn't take it from them in the first place. You just figured it out on your own.
It's in every bottle.
Exactly.
But here's the question. If I figured out your secret formula to fried chicken or Coca-Cola, cola drinks or whatever, and I actually patent it, you're keeping it as a trade secret to keep it secret,
but you,
and I file it, who owns it?
But you couldn't get a patent on it.
Why not?
Because it's in the public. Whether or not they...
It isn't public.
But it is.
It's a secret.
But it's out there. It's so secret in plain sight. I mean, what you're trying to get a patent on has been sold for generations. It exists... It's out there. It's been sold. It's on sale.
It's no longer known.
We don't know what it is, but it's still...
You call it joke instead
of... if I sell software on this for years and years and years, it's out there. We might not know what's on there because we haven't figured out how to break into one of these. We can, but...
So it's not obvious.
It's got nothing to do with obviousness. I'm just saying that it's not new. Somebody's done it before.
It's not novel.
It's not. It fails novelty because somebody's done it before. Yes, that's the legal term. But, geez, if you figure out the formula to Coke and you put it out there, Coke is angry, but they really can't do anything about it.
Rattlesnakes in the glove compartment.
I don't think it's that big of a deal anymore because the value in Coke is not that they've got some secret thing. The value in Coke is that it's Coke. The trademark is the value.
Sure.
In fact, Coca-Cola is the number one value trademark in all the world. Because you go to places and say, I'm thirsty, can I have a Coke? And it doesn't really matter what they give you, you're just expressing that you're thirsty.
No Coke set.
Publicity rights. This one is kind of sort of maybe an intellectual property thing. We'll wrap it up into here that... By and large, a person is entitled to their name, likeness, and image, and they're the only ones that are allowed to profit off of that or enter into contracts that use their own name, likeness, or image. That is to say, if you're famous. If you're not famous, don't know.
Well, how about a case from last 2 weeks ago? Trayvon Martin, that guy that was was shot had his likeness and name trademarked by the family, did they have to do that since he's a public figure, or who owns that?
I think they kind of had an image of a hooded figure trademarked. They tried to. So they're just sort of going for this stylistic image of sorts. If they want to and they want to sell something with that, it's never been, nobody else has that hooded figure looking trademark.
Were selling stuff.
They were.
With his name and some image, and then some of the family patented.
Trademarked.
Trademarked, right, sorry. So my question goes to your point. You own your own image likeness. Why did they have to file for that then?
I don't know what exactly they filed for. My guess is that they filed for some hooded figure-looking thing that you can't tell is Trayvon. Maybe you can kind of tell is Trayvon because of the famous picture, but not really. And to that end, is Trayvon a famous person? Or is it just news and noteworthy right now? There's all kinds of questions that go into this that... some examples of where this sometimes comes up. John Ratzenberger and George Wendt, better known as Cliff and Norm on Cheers, for years and years made their name in the industry being Cliff and Norm on Cheers. So Cheers, or at least a company called Host International, started putting Cheers bars in airports. Has anybody ever gone to a Cheers bar in an airport? I have. I'm sorry I admitted that. So in these Cheers bars in the airports, they would have statues of John Ratzenberger and George Wendt over in the corner at the bar, and it would say Cliff and Norm. And it was just part of the ambiance. Now you know you're in Cheers because they're always there. They sued Host International saying, we didn't authorize you to put our name and likeness up there. You know, we're still George Wendt and John Ratzenberger. You own Cliff and Norm, the characters, but we own us. And they were able to stop them. So if you ever go again and they still do that, they've got two other looking people in a post. Like one guy's just bigger gentleman in a suit, and the other one's in a post office suit. But they don't look anything like John Ratzenberger or George Wendt. And then you're just confused. But they were able to stop that, saying we didn't authorize that. Maybe if Host International approached them and said, we're willing to pay you some money for this, they might have been swayed, but they didn't do that.
You're off to down the street, somebody shoots pictures of you, and you don't want your picture taken. It used to be you could stop them from doing it because you're not a public person. Didn't that change where now if you're in a public facility and somebody shoots your picture, you are stuck with it? It used to be you'd walk up to them and say, hey, you know, you didn't get a model release, I want your film.
It's kind of all over the place. It's if you're in a public place, what is the expectation of privacy when you're in a public place? There again, if somebody is shooting your picture and putting it into their stuff for profit or some kind of gain, you ever watch the news and they've got all the stock footage of people from the shoulders down, especially when they're doing a story about obesity in America? And they have that stock footage of people walking away that are kind of bigger, but you don't see their face. Part of that is we don't have to ask permission because we're not using their face. They're easily recognized as an obese person by other parts of their body. It's kind of ridiculous, but that's part and parcel of what goes into some of those decisions.
What about the social media, you know, like Facebook, whatever, where somebody uploads your picture and then Facebook or whoever claims that they own that picture and your image, what goes on with that? Like if someday you do something and you put your image on a product or something like that, is there a bit of a battle there?
So you put a picture up on Facebook, the Facebook user agreement says whatever pictures end up here, we own
it. Right, but
now you've got your face.
You didn't put it up. Someone else took your picture and put it up.
But keep in mind these publicity rights. You don't necessarily own the idea that you can stop anybody from taking your picture.
Right.
Especially when you're famous, that tabloids have a heyday.
Right. What I'm getting at is when Facebook sees your picture on a can of soup or whatever and says, hey, we own that picture.
No, they own that picture. So, but not you. But not, like, take a different picture. is the real answer. Take a different picture. If you're going to be trying to promote soup with your famous face.
And you have the right to take it down. If you're tagging the picture, you could say, I don't want to have this up. I can at least remove my tag.
You can take away your tag, yes, definitely. But not the picture. The picture still exists in Facebook, right? But
then you can request the poster to take it down. And they can do that.
Or they can say, nope. Yeah. Right. So kind of back to the underlying question is, generally this comes up when somebody else is trying to sell something with your name, likeness, and image. You don't have the absolute right to prevent your name, likeness, and image from getting out there, but you do have some rights with respect to how it's used, and especially if it's being used for commercial purposes. If you don't grant permission for that to happen, you can do that. Another quick example before I take some questions over here. Bette Midler was approached by Ford to do a commercial back in the 70s, way before it was really cool to be approached by car companies to do radio or commercials with your voice, because now everybody kind of does that. But back then, that was selling out, so Bette Midler said, I do not want to do that. Ford hired a person, and they put out a casting call saying, we are looking for somebody to sound exactly like Bette Midler. So they wrote a song, and it was by a Ford, because they're great, or whatever, and had this person sing it, and she sued and said, that sounds like me, and you need to take that down because that's my likeness. And she won. Tom Waits is able to do that with his distinctive voice. The people try to sound like Tom Waits. He's got a heck of a good lawyer. But in the Bette Midler case, you know, there was certain factors that came into the decision that Ford actually approached Bette Midler and then put out the casting call to say, we want somebody like Bette Midler, but we can't get her.
So it's willful. That's,
yeah.
There's more penalties.
That helped sway it the other way to say, you were trying to use Bette Midler's likeness to sell your cars without permission. Because you admitted that's what you're trying to do. If you just happen to sound like Bette Midler and you're trying to sell music, it's likely you're not going to get in trouble with Bette Midler because you're just trying to sell your own music, and you have the great misfortune of sounding like one of the best singers in Western society. Yeah. Questions then?
What expectation does a person have to the use of their name for a web domain?
So, Edward Bauer.
KevinJablonski.com.
I actually have that. I don't think there's any expectation to that. There's got to be a bunch of people named Eddie Bauer in the world.
Yeah.
Or Ralph Lauren. So it's not like Edward Bauer from Wyoming could try to shut down Eddie Bauer Company from doing anything online because I'm Eddie Bauer.
Right.
So in that sense, the ICANN, they don't care. Whoever registers whatever words in a row can do it.
And it doesn't matter if that person's name is Joe Blow.
Right.
Wasn't that the hinge on that kid from British Columbia, Mike Rowe, copyrighted Mike Rowe's song?
Oh.
Interesting. Here's somewhat related to it is... I don't know the guy's first name. I usually just call him Joe. But Joe Nissan had a computer repair outfit in South Carolina, and he bought Nissan.com. Being a computer repair guy and a computer guy, right at the beginning of the outside of the World Wide Web, the information superhighway, he decided to register Nissan.com because that's going to come in handy when I try to market my Joe Nissan computer repair company. Nissan Motor Company came knocking and said, you have to give that to us because we have a trademark in Nissan, and you don't, and we do. And the court said, no, he's doing legitimate work with Nissan.com, and his name is Nissan, so he's entitled to have that. He just got there first. You should have been quicker on the uptake, Nissan Motor Company. So they appealed that, and they still lost, and then took it another level, and they lost again. So, yeah, Joe Nissan won quite a few battles against Nissan Motor Company. I think he ended up selling it to him with the caveat that if the splash page for Nissan has something on the bottom about if you're looking for Nissan computers, go here. I'm not sure if that's still up there. I think it kind of went away. Anybody with an internet connection might check that. But, you know, for years it was up there, that just this little splash page that said, if you're looking for this, go here. And then there was a little bit of a link to the history of it all. It was kind of fascinating little read.
I had to get Rain.com in the early days. Raven and Eagle had it, and I had to do a little bit of stalking to find where they actually were, and they were in Kirkland.
Really?
But they were under a false address, and it was really challenging to actually find this guy. I found him. We paid him $500, and we got Rain.com.
Wow.
So that was interesting back in the day. The thing that's, that drives me crazy about this is the exclusive recording contracts. I was doing reading through that, where it says that by signing this contract, we now own your likeness and your name and what you always look like and what you will look like, and so all the pictures of you over time become ours. And that was basically the last straw for me for exclusive recording contracts.
Yeah, it's kind of, well, it was during a time when record labels had the power to do that, to say, look, we can make you into Madonna, but you need to give everything over to us to begin with, and we'll still make you Madonna.
Steve would need breast implants, though, so.
And it's not size clear.
Is it?
Yeah, it doesn't have it on it.
So it must have ran its course, or Joe Nissan is old enough to not care anymore, who knows?
He owns an island in the South Pacific.
Yeah, I think.
He owns as many Nissans as he wants.
Right. Yes.
My wife and two of her sisters spent a lovely afternoon in the Starbucks one time chatting and visiting. And they sort of noticed on the periphery there was a guy taking pictures of the place. And about 3 months later, she's a piano teacher, one of her students brought in the Starbucks quarterly report or yearly report or something, the book that they published with all their stuff. There was like 8 or 10 pictures of the three of them sitting there in this Starbucks from all different angles and having a good time and no attribution, no permission, no nothing. And we didn't pursue it or anything because what were we going to do?
I don't think you'd have anything there.
Yeah.
You're just in a public place and somebody took a picture.
Clearly, those people.
I can say a friend of mine was in the cafe and had someone come in photographing. It turns out they were photographing for Google Maps, which is extended from the satellite view down to the street level view, and was taking photos of stuff. And presumably they're going to like do something with faces when they actually publish that stuff. But they were kind of wondering about that.
Wouldn't a legitimate company have to have you sign a release for something like that? Because a friend of mine was doing a video shoot for a sushi bar over in Bellevue, and you know everyone who was in the restaurant signed a release saying that they gave their permission to be used on the upload.
Could have been fine print on the door too, if they posted a sheet of paper as you walk in the door, say we may be recording. If you don't like it, don't come in.
It kind of all comes down to some enforcement issues that. You get past any trouble you might run into if you just ask everybody to sign. Say, please give me the rights. We recently went to the Recess Monkeys recording. I have a 2-year-old. If anybody is familiar with the Recess Monkeys at all, they're a group for kids. So I went to their show and they asked us all to sign these releases because they were recording at the time. And they asked us to do crowd sounds so they could mix them back in later. But, you know, we all signed the release form, and that was that. Could I have enforced something if I didn't sign it? It's kind of tough. Like right now, Steve is sending me out over Skype.
To one other person.
To one other person, but I never did get asked permission for that.
Neither did
you. But I'm not going to do anything about it. It is. But
it's when you're famous. So.
Is that how it is?
But you're also being recorded, but you've been asked permission for that.
I think so. Did we ever establish that?
Sorry. And you can't get blood out of a turnip anyway. So.
And if you get hungry, you'll be hungry in an hour.
So in theory, the words and the expression of my ideas that I'm putting together is copyrightable, and it's being recorded over here. So I own that. I'm not going to do anything about it. You can have it. But
see, now it's recorded. Now it's
now you've got it. You've got it memorialized.
It's now in fixed form.
Image. Mm-hmm. Would that extend to the photograph I just took of your slide because I forgot to bring a notepad? If you want to.
I will grant that permission.
Thank you.
Did that get recorded?
But you couldn't have me take the photograph off, couldn't you?
I could.
But you'd have to wrestle you to the ground.
You can kind of see how these, all of these intellectual property rights are, they nest within each other. Everybody has certain rights to different things that they do. You take a picture of what I've already created. Sometimes we all just agree not to get angry with each other, but that always happens. You know? Especially when one side is starting to make a lot of money and the other side isn't, then, well, we can go down that path. 5 minutes. I haven't even got past my first slide.
My friend posted his ticket stub collection, and somebody took it and compiled it into a collage and then basically a centerfold for Rolling Stone magazine for a big ad. Mm-hmm. And it even had his name on several of the tickets without asking his permission. Mm-hmm. And he sued them, and I think he might have won, actually.
Yeah, because that's a nice work of art.
Even though he didn't actually create it.
He did. He arranged them.
No, they put the collage together.
Oh.
He just posted each individual ticket stub.
Still, all right, but each underlying picture, he
it's derivative.
He chose the angle.
Right.
I mean, there's not much there, but he chose the scan. I mean, he could have tilted it ever so slightly, and then I got some art in there. So if I got 5 minutes, let's skip all of this. Well, if I've got 5 minutes before I have to get on with intermission and then the rest of everything else I've got, I think we can jump over to another thing. Because we've kind of talked about these things, the rights conveyed by a copyright. Generally speaking, there's these five that have traditionally been in the 101 section of the 17 U.S.C. Code for Copyright. The right to reproduce the work, right to prepare a derivative work, right to distribute copies, perform the work publicly, and display the work publicly. Those don't always apply to everything. Like, how do you display a music arrangement? Or how do you perform a piece of art on the wall? They've kind of created these rights to cover everything that is subject to copyright protections. And so much so, they couldn't really think of everything in 1998, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act of 1998, also created the right to digitally stream a work, because there's a big question as to whether or not streaming a work was it reproduced? Sort of, but not really. It just played through speakers. Is it distributed? It's not really a copy. It's just streamed. Is it a public performance? So like perform it publicly? Well, one guy sitting in one room with a computer is not necessarily public. There's just too many questions. Is streaming in any of these, per se? And they decided not to answer that question and just create another facet of USC 101. So when you have a copyright, that's what you can do with it.